Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is August 18th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As we always do, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Christian?
How you doing, Neil?
Everything good in Maine? Everything's fine down here in Virginia?
Yep. The temperature's already starting to drop in Maine.
Yeah, well, it's the weather comes and goes. It reminds us how long this pandemic has lasted. I haven't seen you since the early spring, I believe. As always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, I just remind you again, please consider subscribing to our research project, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team here at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can Google it, find out about it. Among other things, you'll be able to get our newswire, watch my show on COVID-19, all my other products, interviews with guests, and so on. As always, we have a very ambitious agenda. We're going to talk today about, we're going to talk about U.S. markets. We're going to go through some of the big three question marks hanging over markets right now. That is, what's happening to stimulus? Where is COVID-19 going? And what's happening to inflation expectations? I think that kind of triangulates it. We're going to talk about all those. And we're going to dive immediately into politics because that's front and center of the news this week. We've got a new choice, I should say the initial choice for the vice presidency by Joe Biden, which is Kamala Harris. And the Democratic convention has already started. We're on day two, right? I think this evening will be the second day. It will last 4 days with obviously Joe Biden capping up on evening four. We're going to talk a little bit about that and how he's doing and will this convention help or hurt. Then we're going to go international. We have some news from Japan. We're going to talk about Hong Kong and Taiwan. They're in the news this week. Thailand, Libya, Belarus, and Jair Bolsonaro. And finally, I really hope to get to this. I want to talk about a recent piece I had in the Newswire on a new projection, population projection, global population projection through the year 2100, which pretty drastically speeds up the pace of global population decline. This is a major study. It got the attention of demographers around the world. It was published in Lancet, which is a extremely prestigious medical journal in Britain. And I hate to even tell you why it's called The Lancet, but, you know, bleeding is to be popular among doctors. Anyway, we won't go into that. But there you have it. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it implies for how not only just what would happen if population followed this trajectory, but what it really implies about different ways of thinking about modeling the long-term future when there are obviously so many variables you don't know about. How heroic should we be in the assumptions we make? It's actually more of almost a philosophical discussion than a discussion about the real world. And with that, we will move into it. So let's just jump right into it. Christian, tell us about markets.
All right, Neil. Well, the S&P 500 is up 0.64% over the last five trading days. Now, we don't know what it closed at today, but it is looking like the S&P might close at a new record. Remember, the record was hit right before the pandemic at 3,386. So be looking for that. And the global Dow, that is up 1.36% over the last five trading days. And as for volatility, the VIX came in at 21.35 yesterday. It's been in that range for a while now.
Well, this is real time, but I can tell you this is as of 15 minutes ago. The S&P 500 did close slightly above its record.
There we go.
So we did it.
We did it.
So what about any economic indicators this month?
All right, Neil, let's get into the markets. The S&P 500 is up 0.64% over the last five trading days. And as of now, the S&P has closed at a new high. It beat its previous high of 3,386. And if we go into the global Dow, that is up 1.36%. And as for the VIX, Neil, that came in at 21.35, where it's been hovering for about a month now.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely more domesticated and stabilized. What about economic indicators, such as they are?
All right, well, for the U.S., we got retail sales for July, month over month. That came in at 1.2%. So not as much growth as we've seen. If you remember June, we had huge numbers of 8.4%. The biggest gain was in electronic sales, and the biggest decline was in sporting and hobby stores. We also got the Michigan Consumer Sentiment preliminary data for August. It was the same as July. You know, most of the discussion is that people are waiting to see what stimulus does. Are people got to get money, or is Congress going to fail to act? We also got industrial production month over month for July. That was up 3%. The largest increase was in motor vehicles and parts. That was up 28.3%. Pretty big there. And I know a topic you want to talk about is housing market. The NAHB Housing Market Index came in at 78 for July. Now, Neil, that is its highest rating since 1998, and blew past projections of 73. So I don't know what you have to say about that.
That's interesting. First of all, industrial production, that was the, obviously, that's the national estimate for the entire calendar month. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So that's obviously capturing a lot of gains early in the month. I think everyone suspects that it slowed down late in the month. The housing is amazing. And we see the big impact of COVID-19. Not so much raising property prices everywhere, but raising them for homes, that is single-family dwellings outside cities. And I think that's something we've really noticed in the prices. If you look at Zillow, I mean, if you look at any of the national price trackers, you can see that suburbs, you've seen this big rise in price pressure. I see it out here. We see it everywhere in the D.C. area. It's happening in a big way around the Bay Area, outside Los Angeles. The reason is people have moved out and they don't want to move back. I mean, you know, partly it's COVID-19, and it's partly the fact that people are getting used to working as we are, Christian, by the internet. And it's when you think about it in the broader context of what we've been talking about happening this year, where multi-generational families are reconnecting. A lot of millennials are coming back home. Relatives are living more with each other and probably tooling up for the fall when at least a few of them are going to be going back to school. Either that or the parents will be going back to work and someone needs to take care of the kids at home. But you see this incredible motion of everything back toward the home, right? Families, more and more adults are living within individual homes. And of course, home is now where increasingly where the work is done. So the single family home is becoming this castle, which is doing more and more. And of course, more and more economic transactions are doing more cooking at home or doing more of our, you know, beautification. And, you know, when I talk about the blow dryer economy, I mean, that's literally happening at home. So I think this revaluation of homes as opposed to urban living is something we're seeing everywhere in the country right now. We're going to have to see how long that lasts. I suspect some of that will be longer lasting. And it's even interesting in light of one part of, Joe Biden's program, which is big new subsidies for housing entitlement, specifically HUD Section 8 housing. We're going to talk about that in a second. But the revival of housing and the importance of homes in America is interesting. You know, even as the centrality of the workplace as a physical place has obviously declined. You know, more broadly, as I look at it, as I was suggesting earlier, three things I look at. One is stimulus, which we've talked about many times. The other is as COVID-19 and inflation expectations. The big news of stimulus, obviously, particularly this last week, is just simply failure. You know, Congress went home. You know, Mitch McConnell just declared that business was done. There's no chance really of getting any deal soon. So, you know, nothing's going to happen until Labor Day at the very earliest. Trump thinks he can get through some sort of half stimulus out of emergency funds that are actually directed by the FEMA, which is a completely different agency. It's unclear how long that's going to take to actually set up. It looks as though no state is ready to use that, and the White House hasn't actually specified how states yet will practically access this money in this program, whereby they put in $100 and the federal government will give $300 and we'll have an extra $400 a month as opposed to the $600 monthly bonus. Right now, we know that it is not happening and that ever since July 25th was the last week, that's the Saturday ending that week, that we had these much larger unemployment benefits. So stimulus has dried up. And what that does to the economy is actually really interesting and somewhat deceptive. If you actually look at some of our real-time population surveys, which actually show a, you know, almost week-to-week update on how employment is doing, you actually see a an uptick in the employment rate and a downtick in the unemployment rate this in August. This was their most recent update of the week of August 15th. So you would look at that and you would initially say, looks like the economy is picking up. You also saw a big decline in initial unemployment claims. It was peaking or actually slightly rising up through the week of July 25th. It rose all the way to 1.4 million. Now we have 2 weeks of steep decline. It's down to 0.96 million, so a substantial decline. Is that a sign of strengthening economy? No. In my opinion, Christian, it's a sign of no benefits. Mm-hmm. So my take is people can't afford to live on the unaugmented state benefit, or at least they're less motivated to pick it up. So they're either not bothering to pick them up or they're going to back to work for less money. What this will do is give an immediate boost to employment, which you see in these real-time indicators, but it also and perversely is going to reduce aggregate demand by pulling down disposable personal income. It's going to act to reduce the economic growth multiplier, the investment accelerator, and inflation pressure. So it's interesting. It is near term and immediately a boost somewhat. I mean, we see it as kind of a little uptick in employment activity due to the people who have to go back to work. But you're missing all that extra income, right? So that is going to have a real impact, a kind of a Keynesian aggregate demand impact on the economy. Unless, of course, full stimulus is reinstated, maybe when Congress returns on Labor Day, in which case everything moves in reverse. So you'd have another near-term rise in claims, right? Everyone say, okay, the gravy train is back. Let's go and, you know, get my benefits again. You'd actually see unemployment actually falling somewhat, but a longer-term demand-driven growth. Presumably that time the deal would be through till the end of, till the end of the year when you know, the next president or the, you know, either Trump or Obama would take on a new term. Then the other variable here is COVID-19. We don't see a lot of change since last week. The last couple of weeks, death rates are stabilizing at just over 100,000. 1,000 per week. 1,000 per week on a 7-day average basis. The new cases are moving down. They were about 80,000. Now they're down just over 50,000. It's a glass half empty, half full. I mean, you can see with the stimulus, is that good news or bad news for stimulus? It's kind of unclear. It's kind of mixed. Same way with COVID-19, kind of mixed news. Although clearly, as I've said many times, both here and on our COVID report, the United States is, you know, truly way behind the rest of the affluent world in dealing with this problem. I noted a remark the other day, I think you saw it too, Christian, Donald Trump, how he responded to the news from New Zealand, that they now have, you know, a handful of new cases. They had 6 cases one day, then 8 cases, I think, a couple days later. So they have somewhere between, 6 and 12 cases the last few days. And Trump said, at a campaign rally, they thought they had it beat. You know, they were really, you know, crowing about how well they were doing. And then came this big surge, and, you know, and it was whoops. And, you know, it's terrible in New Zealand now. It's just terrible. Anyway, I think we have a what can I say? I think I could say an innumerate president, because interestingly, the number of new infections in New Zealand is absolutely minuscule on any scale. I mean, New Zealand is such a safe country that there has been no impingement for the last month and a half in mobility. People are going around without masks. New Zealand is an object lesson in successful containment policy. They have maybe 10 new infections recently with this new scare. It's true. They're trying to contain it. It may have been brought in through food. They don't know. 10 new infections in a day. The United States has 35 new infections every minute. I mean, how was that? New Zealand's last death occurred on May 28th. But if New Zealand had the same per capita death rate as the United States, let's just scale it down, New Zealand would be having 18 deaths every day. In other words, New Zealand remains a incredible, very impressive success story. And I think they're to be congratulated for everything they did well, if only Americans would just learn from it. I mean, you don't have to like anything else about New Zealand. I mean, you don't have to like you don't have to like the prime minister. You don't have to like their politics. I don't care what you just look at their system and how they applied it. As for inflation expectations, I think it's very interesting to see how that's going to be buffeted by this failure of stimulus. As you know, in the last few podcasts, we've been talking about increasing inflation expectations. You see many of the symptoms, or I should say, signals continue. The dollar continues to trend down, but it's going to be interesting to see the impact if stimulus remains unclosed, if we have no deal, and particularly if states find it hard to cash in on any way into sort of Trump's jury-rigged promises, you could suddenly see the risk in the economy suddenly start to push back toward, you know, a little bit more deflation contraction instead of the less contraction and certainly accelerating inflation or accelerating inflation trend on a rate of change basis over time, which is at Hedgeye what we call our quad three scenario. All right, all of that done. Now let's move on to the Democrats and their two big pieces of news from that party. One is the selection by Joe Biden of his vice presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. We've talked a lot about his VP picks in the past. He's kept this on hold for a long time. I don't know. I'm going to give you, Christian, my first reaction to this. I think it's a safe, risk-averse choice. Most importantly, she's vetted. She's used to the national stage. She comes from she's been senator from a very large state. She's been on the national campaign trail. As long as we're in positives, I mean, I'll mention them. She has charisma. You know, she's spunky. You know, she's not afraid to go at Joe Biden. We saw that during the debates. And you know, I don't know, the Republicans may be quoting some of Kamala Harris' charges against Joe, and you know how up to date he is on his attitudes toward racism. So we'll see that. The ethnicity, I think, is great. It's a draw for both Asians and African Americans. I think you can say that's kind of unusual. Although I must say, both Asians and African Americans are now firmly in the Democratic camp. But you know, this could get them maybe more motivated to go out and vote. She has prosecutor experience. I think that hurt her with Democrats, particularly on the left. I actually think it may help her with mainstream America. You know, she's used to going out and prosecuting criminals. She's a lawyer. Well, that hurts her with everyone, but I mean, most politicians are lawyers. I think about three quarters of downtown D.C. and K Street, I mean, they're all lawyers. So you can't get away from that. I think the thing that turned a lot of people off a little bit, certainly the middle of America, was the way Biden conducted the vice presidential search as a kind of affirmative action identity politics process. You know, it has to be a woman, and that probably should be a woman who's non-white and all that. Joe Biden could have chosen the same VP without ever talking about any of that, right? He would have gotten all the positives without any of the negatives. I still think that there were some clearly riskier candidates that were overlooked. We've talked about many of them, you know, on this podcast. But, you know, it's done. That's a deal. I don't know if you have any other thoughts about Kamala Harris. She obviously doesn't bring a state that's important.
Right.
But, you know, there she is. And I think also the idea was is that someone like Elizabeth Warren could remain active, you know, maybe is going to be Secretary of Treasury. She may still be active in leading legislation in the Senate. I think that might have been a consideration there. I think she has, you know, prime time quality. You know, she doesn't. One thing I will say, maybe there's a little on the negative side, but also maybe why Biden chose her. She doesn't have much of a policy agenda on her own. I don't know if you recall, but when it came to health reform, she was the very last to even think about it. She didn't even have a plan. I mean, how could you not know that something has to be done with you know, the 18-19% of our GDP that's being run into the ground, you know, through our current healthcare system? She didn't really have any particular, you know, feeling toward it, even after the other candidates were chewing each other up over the exact design of their healthcare program. It's interesting. She's clearly she's clearly a feminist. She's clearly, you know, believes in progressive attitudes when it comes to ethnicity and race. But she's not programmatic in any kind of socially or economically that I see. And that's sort of an interesting aspect of her. Maybe Biden liked that and meant that, you know, that she would be fine, I don't know, serving her. Well, the Democratic convention has begun. We talked about that earlier, four different days. I would say the thing that stressed me most is the, and I know you have some thoughts about it too, so I'm going to come to that in a second, Christian, but I would say the thing that impressed me most is the stress on moderation. I mean, this is a very cagey Democratic Party. You know, they want to make sure that, you know, any of middle America which cares to see this thing, and I'm not sure how many there are. I think it's mainly the Democratic partisans are going to tune in, and they may not be pleased by the stress on moderation. But everything is on how, you know, apple pie and mainstream this party is. This is, you know, you even got Bernie Sanders, who's basically saying, I totally support Joe Biden, even though he wasn't in favor of any of my, you know, radical institutional makeovers. You had them bring on four Republicans who are turncoats. I'm sure Trump is going to call them turncoats. John Kasich, Susan Molinari, Christine Whitman, and Meg Whitman. These are all people who've been involved in Republican politics, probably most of all John Kasich, who's been both, he was head of the Budget Committee. He's been in politics for a long time, and obviously later governor of Ohio. I already know how the White House is going to attack these people. These are all what's wrong with the Republican Party, full of Wall Street. I mean, all these people are Wall Street types. John Kasich served with Lehman Brothers, and Susan Molinari was a former Google VP, and Christine Whitman, you know, she was, I believe she's also served on boards, and Wegman Whitman, most of all. She actually helped organize Romney's campaign, but she was a former president of HP, and I believe she was on Procter and Gamble's board. I don't know, but I did think that that was impressive that they would bring in these Republicans to talk about how they, you know, don't really agree with a lot of what the Democrats stand for. It's just maybe a little bit of Joe Biden's tactic, which he may do as well if he wins, is to set up sort of a unity government. It's been said that Joe Biden will try to bring in some Republicans to serve on his cabinet. This is what you'd expect of the silent generation, right? Get everyone to feel like they're part of the process. There's always a compromise. There's always a way we can bring everyone together. One thing you might ask, before I move on, what did you feel about it? I don't know, the Democratic Convention.
Neil, when I was watching it, to me, it looked like a terrible infomercial. And I know they're restricted that you can't have a live audience, but it seemed very canned, it was awkward, clunky, and to me, the idea that there's going to be four nights of this, I don't know anyone who's going to watch all four nights. It was not enjoyable to watch, and I'm not really sure what purpose it has. You know, I know they have the limitations, but I think they should have made it a one-night event. To me, I don't know how much this is going to help them in the general election.
Well, this is, you know, join the crowd. This has been a criticism of political conventions now for many years. It's been decades since these conventions actually did anything, right? Back in the old days, you know, these were the actual nominees were selected. But then we started having, you know, primaries everywhere. So these delegates are just following orders, and the outcome is already predetermined. And there's a big debate, actually, as to whether these changes, this democratization of the primary system, is actually effective. Do we end up nominating better candidates? Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, did it work when the Republicans chose, you know, Donald Trump in 2016? Did it? I mean, I don't know. Is it working now that the Democrats are choosing Joe Biden? It's unclear to me whether this actually generates better candidates or even more electable candidates. It sure didn't seem like a slam dunk to me. But I will say, now that it is the business of the primary voters to select candidates, that's what conventions have become, basically an infomercial. And the difference is today they're not even spontaneous, right? It's kind of like watching... it's watching an NHL playoff game, you know, with no audience. It's a little weird, but I grant you this is probably worse. The Joe Biden platform, what is it? And it's really not much. You know, I've actually been interested. People often ask me, well, you know, policy wise, how's the Biden, you know, at least what Biden wants as opposed to what the, you know, party may, you know, twist his arm to do. But what does Biden want, right? Well, he obviously wants to roll back, you know, Trump's tax reform. He's going to raise taxes on high-income people. Big minimum wage increase to $15. That's an increase in the federal minimum wage. That is going to impact a lot of businesses in the service sector. There's a huge debate, by the way, in the economics profession about whether minimum wage increases, help or hurt, and on what conditions they do. I would say 20, 30 years ago, most economists thought minimum wages are terrible. I think there's been a big change now because of monopsony effects on employers. And I think you find a lot of economists on both sides of the minimum wage today Free College, College for All Act, which he supported. That's, you know, that's what he's going to help. That's what he's going to do for millennials. What's he going to do for homelanders? Well, he wants a lot more federal money for K through 12 schooling in low income areas. He's going to, quote unquote, enhance the Affordable Care Act. We don't know. Will he support a public option? Unclear. He's left that vague and complex. And some big new housing act. This is what I talked about earlier. A lot of Democrats, and Biden's been big on this, he wants to make Section 8 an entitlement, which now it isn't. Section 8 actually, you know, makes eligible a large number of poor Americans for subsidies in their housing, but some 75% of the eligibles have to wait in line because there isn't enough money for it. Making Section 8 an entitlement would mean that the money would automatically be made available. It would be kind of like food stamps or TANF for Social Security or Medicaid or anything else, right? So it would be different. I don't know. Does this convention help or hurt? I think you already answered that question. One thing will be very interesting is how different the Trump convention will be, right? I don't know. We'll have to see about that. Well, let's just move here into international waters. I think you have for an opener, we had not much economic news this month. I think we did have news about Japan, and then I guess we'll just stay in Asia for a while.
Yes, Japan had their GDP growth rate quarter over quarter for their second quarter, and it came in at -7.8%. So that is the third straight quarter of contraction in Japan and its steepest decline on record, Neil.
Wow. So, yeah, that's definitely a recession. We'll see whether it's a fourth straight month after that. You know, Shinzo Abe is worried about it. His popularity has declined quite a bit. People sort of see him as a spent force. He's not going to be with Japan for much longer. There's a little bit of jockeying to see who's going to succeed him. And I think it's one of the reasons, too, the state of the economy, why he's been so unwilling to support any more aggressive action on COVID, which Japan really has been spared much damage. But now that they've had, you know, a little bit of, you know, second wave surges, particularly in Tokyo, he didn't want to do anything that would upset the economy. Although I think what Japan is really suffering from is just the global decline. You know, not so much that not so much what's happening inside of Japan, but how Japan is suffering from what's happening everywhere else. What about Hong Kong?
Well, we are starting to see the effects of some of these U.S. sanctions on Chinese officials. The leader of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, she's pretty much a puppet of Beijing. She has said her credit cards have been frozen, and the Hong Kong police chief has shifted his mortgage to the Bank of China, and you're seeing a lot of these politicians making some financial changes to their personal lives.
Well, it's kind of like a lot of that squirming we saw from a number of Russians after Putin invaded the Ukraine, right? So, gosh, and I got to move my assets. Yes, there are 11 named individuals that have been sanctioned. I think I've been talking about this for a while. I think that Hong Kong is a slow motion train wreck with huge ultimate consequences for the world. In that, I think the analogy I gave was World War I, where, you know, one thing keyed another thing, which keyed another thing, and you can kind of all see them going. I think the problem with Hong Kong is that once the crackdown, I think Xi Jinping is absolutely firmly resolute on carrying through with this and absolutely stamping out any dissent in Hong Kong. I think that that's been galling him now for, you know, the better part of a year and a half, and I think most of China is behind him in doing that. I think they've been, I think he's reflecting the will of the Chinese people in doing that. But I think it will have an inevitable effect, not just on the United States, but on the UK and on ultimately on Europe. You're going to see, the decision on Huawei and 5G. That's right now in Angela Merkel's court. You've seen UK already make their decision against China. And ultimately, when you start seeing people getting hurt in China and when you see the crackdown, there will be this a growing uproar to actually do something about it and apply sanctions, not just to individuals, but to companies. And when it's companies, then you get the effect of what we've seen when the U.S. does sanctions on Iran or North Korea or Hezbollah or wherever else we've applied sanctions. It applies to all U.S. banks. It applies to any U.S. bank, any non-U.S. bank that transacts through the U.S. financial system. And it's secondary, any bank involved in transactions with individuals or firms, right? And if banks are holding any assets, if any person or firm owns more than 50% of that thing, say it's a company, that asset must be frozen. So this has an immediate domino spread, right? And I think that when this is applied to firms, this might suddenly cause a lot of the global trade, anything involving China, to kind of come screeching to a halt. And the reason I say this is likely politically is that it's a winner politically. These sanctions bills are the only thing I know in the past several years that have gone through both houses in Congress with hardly one dissenting vote, either among Republicans and Democrats. And how often have we seen an absolutely unanimous bipartisan decision to enact something? And of course, the Democrats are challenging Trump. They think Trump is being too soft on the Chinese. You know, he's just one of those big authoritarian bullies. He didn't want to do anything mean to Uncle Xi. Trump is saying, no, these Democrats are wussies. You know, they're not going to take on Xi like I can. Anyway, they're, it's a competition to see who can be as hardline as they can on China. I'm not optimistic about that. And meanwhile, we've got the Taiwan situation as well. Is that right?
Yes, Neil, we have two stories out of Taiwan here. The U.S. has finalized a deal to sell the island 66 new F-16 fighters. Now, this was announced a year ago, but they've finally signed the paperwork and it's good to go. And our other little story is that the HHS Secretary, Alex Azar, visited Taiwan, and now this is the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit the island since 1976. So, of course, both of these stories have pissed off China, and they have been flying fighter jets that have been crossing the median point of the Taiwan Strait. And an article I was reading, since 1999, they've only done this three times. So, it's usually right when things get pretty tense that this happens.
Well, and in response, Taiwan is actually locking on these fighter jets with anti-aircraft missiles, right?
Right.
So, this is, you wouldn't want anyone pressing the wrong button at the wrong time when that happens. Well, it's interesting that Secretary Azar is visiting. Apparently, Trump doesn't trust him to lead the anti-COVID effort, so we might as well be doing something else, like expanding our relations abroad. Who says an HHS secretary can't do, you know, amazing things in other departments? This is obviously a sign of tension going up everywhere, and a sign of, I think, the deteriorating overall mood of U.S.-China relations. U.S. and China are gradually but inexorably economically disengaging. Interestingly, according to Silk Road Associates and Baker McKenzie, China's exports of their, you know, that are tracked, 1,200 products, accounted for 22% of global exports in 2019. That's down from 25% in 2018. And a lot of that, they suspect, reflects a big decline in multinational trade, meaning trade within multinational corporations that are beginning to relocate outside of China, who are just sense what's coming up, almost regardless of who's president. Russia and China, who are continuing to be closer together, now conduct more than 50% of their trade not in dollars. And you think, well, that's you know, is that surprising? Well, only about 3 or 4 years ago, almost all of their trade continued to be in dollars because it's so much more convenient, all right, in U.S. dollars financially. So you can see all of this disengagement we're talking about happening. I think that the big question mark, and I've opined on that in this podcast, I've quoted Kissinger and many others who basically say that China actually hopes that Trump is reelected, you know, partly because Xi Jinping gets along with Trump and Trump, you know, finally, yeah, okay, he's a big hawk on trade and all that. China can handle that. They don't really mind that. What they like about Trump is two things. One is he doesn't bother him, but doesn't really care much about human rights issues. And China's adamant that they're not going to take instructions from the rest of the world on human rights. And secondly, they figure that, you know, whenever Trump's in power, you tend to get chaos in America. So that works to their advantage too. So I think they like that. And I should say there's a third point too, and that is Trump actually does everything he can to prevent the West from gathering together into an anti-Chinese coalition on any of these issues, whether it's you know, regard to proper trade practices, business practices within China, or human rights. Let's move on. I think Thailand has been in the news lately. Is that correct?
That is right. We are seeing large-scale protests in Bangkok against the military. Now, these are the largest protests, Neil, since 2014 when there was a military coup. The protesters started as a student movement calling for democracy. And what's different this time is that a lot of older people have actually joined the movement. Now, in Thailand, they actually haven't had that many cases of COVID-19, but with travel going away, Bangkok has lost all of its tourism. There's reports of just people starving in the streets. The city is in a true mess right now, and people are calling for reforms. And, you know, there's a lot of laws here about criticizing the government that can get you huge prison sentences. So the fact that there's thousands of people in the street, this doesn't normally happen.
Yeah, this is, you know, Thailand's an anomalous case. They've really been subject to almost no political modernization movement. They're politically, formally, they're a feudal system.
Right.
I mean, they're a monarchy. They have a military who's put in charge by the monarchy and who basically supports the monarchy. They have a current king who nobody respects, unlike the last one who reigned for a long time and did win the respect of most Thais. You know, this guy, I think he's a millennial. He's what, in his mid-30s, and he's a rake, right? And he's famously corrupt, or at least he signs off on the most corrupt tendencies of the military monarchy alliance. And you know, young professionals are sick of it. I think one interesting aspect of this uprising is something that people don't really think about, but that is in that whole area of Southeast Asia, Thailand is a uniquely affluent economy. When you look them up, they are about $21,000 per capita in, you know, purchasing power parity GDP. 21,000. That's pretty good. That's on par with the more affluent countries in Eastern Europe, Romania or Belarus, which you're going to talk about in a second. But it's way above Vietnam, Laos, that are down around 8,000, 9,000. Myanmar, Cambodia, they're all way down. So here we got this affluent economy that really has more in common economically with Malaysia to their south than to all their neighbors. And yet they run as this completely feudal kingdom. It's odd. And obviously it's a flashpoint. They're doing terribly economically at the moment. Why Southeast Asia has been so little subject to COVID-19 is interesting. I mean, some biologists think that it's partly because this population may have already been accustomed or habituated to some similar coronavirus. A lot of theories about that. Others that they simply practice more natural social distancing. I know that's been That's been a suggestion about why it's been so low in Japan, despite the lack of formal measures. But all that said, it's going to be interesting to see. We'll track that, right, in the weeks to come. And speaking of demonstrations against dictatorships, we might as well move directly over to Belarus.
Yes, Neil. Well, they had their presidential election, and no surprise there that President Lukashenko won re-election with 80% of the vote. But the people of Belarus are not happy. They know that this was obviously a fraudulent election, and hundreds of thousands of people have been in the streets protesting. And this has never happened before, and they are putting massive pressure on him to resign. So who sees this as a great opportunity? None other than Putin. He thinks that these protesters are being planted by the West. He has told France and Germany to stay out of Belarus, and he has said that he might even invade with his military to defend the government of his friend.
Well, you know, with friends like that, who needs any enemies? And I will say the history of the last five centuries in Central and Eastern Europe has been one of Russia invading on behalf of our Slavic brothers. Right? It's that's the old Eastern European joke, right? Choose your country, right? Poland, Bulgaria, whatever it is. It says, I don't understand. Are Russians are they our friends or our brothers? And the answer is, well, they must be our brothers because you get to choose your friends. So there you go. I think we have some comment about Libya and Cyprus. I know we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, the ongoing flashpoint at Sirte, which is kind of where the Egyptian-backed forces in Libya are on the one hand, and the Turkish-backed forces on the other. Do we have an update on that?
Right. There hasn't been any fighting yet. But what we do know is that the U.S. ambassador to Libya has made a statement that he is in talks to try to make a demilitarize the city. Because remember, if Sirte falls, Egypt says they're invading Libya. It's kind of the flashpoint of this whole civil war. So nothing yet. We don't know if these agreements will actually happen or if they'll be successful. But there does seem like there's some international pressure to try to de-escalate the issues.
And meanwhile, there's something happening in Cyprus, right? We actually touched on that, both Cyprus and Malta, and the importance of the oil drilling rights around those islands.
Right. So the water around Cyprus is pretty much divided between eight countries for drilling. And who's absent is Turkey. They're not allowed in that region. Well, Turkey thinks they have a right. And they have gone into some contested waters that are owned by both Cyprus and Greece. And they went in with a survey ship and their navy. And this has caused a massive crisis that France has now deployed some of their warships into the Mediterranean Sea because Greece is furious about this and Greece has asked them for help. Greece is now in a talks with Egypt to make an alliance against Turkey. And it really looks like this whole thing is kind of spiraling out of control. It's getting put in with the Libyan civil war, and we don't really know where this is going to end.
Wow, this is Emmanuel Macron using his force de frappe.
Yes.
You know, this France bearing its muscles and actually showing that the European Union, yes, it does have a foreign policy. Well, I mean, it takes France, I guess, to do that. Well, we'll certainly be tracking that. I've always said that, though, that Turkey has always been a question mark to me. And I hope at some future date to actually talk a little bit about the legacy of, Kemal Atatürk and the Ottoman Empire and kind of, you know, what happens when you represent the shadow of a former empire. You kind of look around and you think, well, this used to be mine. I do think about that a little bit. When you're a former empire, if you're Iran, you used to be the Persian Empire. If you're Greece, you used to be the Byzantine Empire, right? I mean, we all have illusions of former glory to which the present seems, you know, a sort of an impoverished figment of, you know, what used to be ours. And I do think that that actually pulls people into situations they wouldn't otherwise get into. But they all overlap in that part of the world. I think we're just about out of foreign news. We have one last thing, I believe, Brazil. Is that right?
Right. I'd like to say, Neil, Bolsonaro is one lucky guy. You know, a month ago, all the talk was, can he keep on the power? Will he be impeached? And he got COVID-19, and his poll numbers have turned around. There's a lot of talk of there was a lot of sympathy for him. He's also started direct cash payments to the poorest members of Brazil. And his approval rating is just as high as it was when he was first elected. He's at 37% of the population say he's either doing a good or great job, and about 26% say he's doing a fine job. These are some of the best numbers he's ever seen, and the whole talks of impeachment seem to have disappeared.
We'll see if that luck lasts. You know, Boris Johnson also got a big boost after he got COVID, and it looked like he nearly died, right?
Right.
That hasn't lasted so well. Jair Bolsonaro is fascinating because this is the second time he was almost killed. I don't know if you recalled, in campaigning initially for the presidency, he was attacked by a demonstrator and knifed. And it caused a huge sympathy wave in his favor, by the way. And he won with a sizable majority, right? Something like 55%.
Right.
And he came in on a wave. Of course, at that time, he had some big structural reforms, some of which he actually accomplished to his credit. You know, pension reform being a big one that I've talked about on this podcast, how essential that was for Brazil. But now, of course, his experience with COVID has been lamentable. I should say almost pathetic. And most of his quality cabinet members have left his administration. Well, we'll see. We'll see where he goes. I do want to get on. Maybe we actually have time now to actually talk about my Newswire story, because I ran a piece. It was kind of one of my longer pieces about a new study, again, mentioned it earlier, is published in The Lancet, and it was actually done by the University of Washington. It was the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. That's the same group, actually, that we quote every couple of weeks on our COVID report. They actually do the COVID case and death predictions for the United States. I think they're certainly listened to by the White House. They're listened to by, I think, everyone in Washington on that. Anyway, a very experienced outfit. And they came up with a major new study that suggests that the world population will peak decades ahead of the UN forecast, thanks to declining fertility rates. Instead of the year 2100, this study estimates the global population will peak at, and by the way, 2100 is, I should say, just by happenstance, exactly the year when, according to the current UN forecast, global population will peak and then it will gradually decline. According to this new Lancet study, it will peak in the year 2064, and that the elderly will also make up, obviously, fertility declines, you know, aging occurs much faster. And it's interesting, Christian, when I look back on the history of population forecasting, and just it makes me reflect on the changes we've seen 40 or 50 years ago. You know, this probably will not bring back memories to millennials or many Xers, but 40 or 50 years ago, most demographers subscribed to an absolutely apocalyptic set of long-term forecasts of unsustainable global population growth. And I think iconic of that era was Paul R. Ehrlich in his bestseller Population Bomb, which was published in 1968. It announced that it was already too late. Soaring birth rates would condemn humanity to massive famines and raw material shortages. Hundreds of millions would die of starvation in the 1970s, and there would be Malthusian food shortages even in the United States by the 1980s. Well, you know, none of that happened. I should say, none of that happened. Not much of it happened. Certainly nothing happened in the United States. Food actually got cheaper. In the decades since, demographers have been chasing. I would say it's fair to say demographers have been steadily pulling back on their long-term demographic growth scenarios. And if you want to know the reason, mostly because of the steady and unexpected declines in fertility across most of the planet. Should be news to most, you know, of my listeners. And what happened was not just the post-war baby boom in the high-income world. It was actually mainly in the kind of Anglo-Saxon economies. It was mainly in the United States and Britain and Australia, a little bit in Europe. But it became clear that baby boom had collapsed. It was short-term. And it was even more importantly that birth rates were steadily falling across most low-income societies, especially in East Asia, more dramatically, and in Latin America. By around 2000, demographers were anticipating, most of them, I believe, were anticipating that global fertility, the global total fertility rate, which we sometimes call the TFR, would eventually stabilize at something under 2.1, which is the replacement rate, and that global population would eventually plateau or decline. It's that trend toward estimating lower and lower population growth has continued in the years since 2000. In its last revision of its world population prospects in 2019, the UN Population Division forecasted for the first time in its medium scenario that global population would peak at 10.8 billion in the year 2100, as I just said a little bit earlier. And so you can see this downward trend proceeding, and many other groups, particularly the group in Vienna, the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, which is run by Wolfgang Lutz, someone I know and is very, very famous at this, actually predicts a lower peak at 9.4 billion in 2070, and so on. So we see this general trend among demographers. Why are most demographers even assuming now even lower population growth than the UN? And I would say because they believe, most of them, that the UN Population Division, and I will say that the UN Population Division still represents the gold standard in their acquisition of data and their methods for most demographers. But I think there's an increasing consensus that the UN pays no attention to and therefore underestimates the long-term social and cultural forces driving fertility lower across most of the world. And you and I know what these are, Christian. These include greater affluence, mm-hmm. growing urbanization, rising educational attainment, particularly among women, increasing individualism and free agency, things like markets, the socialization of retirement, which means, you get a free ride if you're single. I'll sum it up quickly. Growing secularism, that is declining religiosity. The UN demographers believe that societies manifest a long-term tendency to gravitate always back up to a replacement rate of something close to 2.1. So the UN assumption has been that there's this long-term magnet that, even for these very low fertility rates that we see in most of the West today, that it will eventually go back up, right? Even as Sub-Saharan Africa is coming down, South Asia is going down, these Western countries will go back up. These new demographers say there's no reason to assume that. And that's true of this new Lancet team. What they do is they tie each society's total fertility rate to two critical variables: average years of educational attainment and the availability of female contraception, expresses a ratio to the number of women who express a desire to limit their family size. So, the lower the ratio, the more they see change in favor of further decline in fertility. So, that's it. When you look at the implications of this, according to the Lancet scenario, the global population will peak in 2064 at only 9.73 billion, so we will never get to 10. This peak will occur 36 years earlier than the UN projection and at a number which is 11% lower. By 2100, the global population will decline to 8.8 billion and the global TFR will be at only 1.66. Global TFR will be at 1.66. That's slightly beneath where the US was in 2019, 1.71. And that's probably actually above what the yields will be in 2020. That's another story. But we're going to see continued decline this year, no question. Also by 2100, 183 of the world's 195 nations will have TFRs beneath 2.1. That is to say, under replacement. And 23 nations will have population declines of over 50% since 2017. These include Japan, Thailand, and Spain. China will decline by 48% from 2017. Meanwhile, the U.S., though in decline by 2100, will actually be more populous in 2100 than 2017. Why? Because our fertility rate will remain larger, and we will have continue to have more immigration. United States, rumors to the contrary, continues to be a very high immigrant country. So where does this, what's my overall take on this? I think the Lancet team did a very good job technically. I think that what their projections imply for global aging are obviously extremely dramatic. You know, if you have fewer and fewer kids, it means the average age of populations will climb even faster than they are today. Here's just a couple of little factoids, which I think will be interesting. In 1950, 25 births occurred worldwide for every one person turning 80 years old. By 2100, according to this new Lancet projection, there will be only one birth for every new 80-year-old. In countries experiencing more than a 25% population decline by 2100, and obviously that's going to be dozens of countries, the ratio of people over age 80 to children younger than 15 will grow 9 times from what it was in 2017. It will grow from 0.17 to 1.5. There will be 50% more people over age 80 than under age 15. Compared to today, the number of Chinese aged 20 to 24, just think about, young adults in China, will shrink by nearly 2/3. These are dramatic changes, Christian. And, overall, let me just sum up my feelings. I have mixed feelings about, what Professor Murray and the Lancet Project does. I agree with jettisoning the UN's assumption that fertility rates have to gravitate back to replacement as if by a law of nature. On the other hand, I worry about researchers' tendency to endogenize long-term variables like fertility because these efforts become hopelessly selective in the new assumptions that they presume will drive future events. These researchers in particular believe they found a very stable recent relationship linking fertility to education and contraception. But how do they know if this relationship will remain stable in future decades? What about all the other developments, predictable or not, that they are not considering, maybe because they're not as easy to measure? I'll name a few, like nationalism, war, depression, advanced technologies, civil conflict, novel forms of political organization, new social and religious movements. I don't know. I think you get what I'm talking about. I also think that they, again, even though they do consider GDP, they make no effort to check its living standard projections against economic plausibility. I've written about that many times in our newswire. Even assuming falling fertility, both in the Lancet projection and in the UN projection, the assumption is the economy of Nigeria is someday supposed to support a population nearly double the size of today's European Union. I mean, I'm sorry, but if you look at Nigeria, it's based mostly on subsistence agriculture. Unless they have a productivity miracle, that country, that size, and you could talk too about Ethiopia and Yemen and a number of other countries, you cannot mechanically project a fertility rate on a fixed territory with no attention to its underlying economy. You'd have to say, difficult it is to say, it's not falling fertility that capped population growth in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Rather, it is just simple Malthusian limits to extreme population density in one of the poorest regions on Earth. Now, they could have fertility growth that could be much more dramatic than we've seen. They also could have economic breakthroughs and productivity growth much more dramatic. I agree with all that. It could be. I'm just saying, if you're doing something that's most probable based analysis, you wouldn't be betting on that. More generally, I would have to say, and maybe this is where I'll go with this, is that you look at all these assumptions they make, these researchers, and it reminds me a little bit of Francis Fukuyama's end of history scenario, right? Which is that the continued dominance of a liberal democratic political and cultural model in which greater education and individualism always, militates against births. It's a benign scenario in which everyone gets richer and has more choices. National borders remain fixed. But what if that's that model, by generating steep population declines in many societies, results in end-stage vicious cycle effects? I mean, what if it results in mounting debt, redundant land and capital stock, grandfather clause entitlements, declining economic dynamism, mass emigration of the young? Do you think young are just going to stick around in those countries that are terminal? And what if these countries are ultimately displaced, or maybe invaded by more demographically expansive neighbors? So might we not expect some competition to displace this model? I often think there's demographics is the game of last man standing. And one thing about fertility in history is very low fertility societies tend eventually to disappear, and then they become irrelevant, right? Something else takes its place. And I think we forget that a little bit. If you, no matter where you are, in what society you are, but over time, if you fail to persist, fail to flourish, you will become in time irrelevant. I had actually, in a book I wrote a number of years ago with Richard Jackson, The Graying of the Great Powers, I have this one quote. We have a long chapter on sort of the history of demographic thinking about politics, but I'll quote it here. Demographic change shapes political power like water shapes rock. Up close, the forces look trivial, but viewed from a distance of decades or centuries, it moves mountains. In AD 900, Berlin had no Germans, Moscow had no Russians, Budapest had no Hungarians, Madrid was a Moorish settlement, and Constantinople had hardly any Turks. Normans had not yet settled in Britain, and before the 16th century, there were no Europeans living in the Western Hemisphere. Anyway, that's the perspective I would like to leave, is just our lack of knowledge of everything that can happen. I think there's always an advantage and a simple humility to the sort of modeling that the UN Population Division used to do before they, came up with all this complex Monte Carlo modeling. And, the UN also tries to endogenize what they do. What the UN used to do is, I think, the purest and best of the projection methods. You know what they used to do? They used to simply say, we have a high, middle, and low option. Let me tell you what they are. Yeah, high option, fertility rate is going to do this. Middle option, it's going to just stay steady. Low option, it's going to go down. Let's just generate all the population numbers based on that. And, we have some longevity assumptions. We have a few migration assumptions. But to me, that's pure. It's basically saying, we don't know what's going to influence those things, but we'll just tell you if-then statements, right? I think there's a purity of that. I think there's a humility of that kind of modeling. So with that, maybe long explanation of, the kind of work that I often spend my time doing, which is in demography, let's close there. I think we're way over our time limit. As always, thanks for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you again next week. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.